Now it is my pleasure to present to you the Founders Day speaker. Mr. Tharp L. Woolford is an attorney at law here in the city of Louisville. He holds the Bachelor of Arts from Harvard College and the Doctor of Jurisprudence from Harvard Law School, the Master of Arts from the University of Louisville. He has been a lecturer in English at the University of Louisville, and from 1955 to 1972, he is not only a member of the bar here in this city, he is a member of many of the important civic clubs within the city, including the Filson Club, which is a club that majors on history in this area, the Executive Clubs Club of Louisville, the Arts Club of Louisville, and the University of Louisville Library Associates. He is a trustee of Franklin College. He has published essays in the history of early American law, published by Chapel Hill in 1969. His father, Mr. Leo Woolford, served as a trustee of Southern Seminary from 1944 to 1968 and was a valued member of the board. This is a historic occasion in that, so far as I have been advised or know, Mr. Woolford is the first bona fide layman to deliver a Founders Day address at Southern Seminary. We have asked him to speak on this occasion, which marks the 100th year of the existence of Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. We felt we wanted a member of the Louisville community to look at us as well as our locale and tell us something of the life we have had together for these 100 years. An honored friend of the seminary and a Baptist layman respected throughout this community, Mr. Tharp Woolford.
I could not tell you how honored I am to be here today. I'm always inspired by this student body embarking upon so great a career, and by this campus, and by your president, whom I have respected so many years. I'm a little nervous about introductions, since I heard at Kiwanis, as the speaker was beginning to assemble his notes, the program chairman state, "Our speaker today needs no introduction," and then sit down. Well, then there was the one who introduced the speaker in a manner such as this. I don't know whether our speaker has anything to say or not, but if he does, we might as well hear it. And if he doesn't, we might as well get it over with. Well, on this Founders Day, this special Founders Day, there is something to say, a great story to tell. A novel can be as dramatic as history. No dream as impressive as reality. What novelist would dare create an institution celebrating in a single year the bicentennial of its first two presidents' birth, the centennial of its removal to this city shortly after the city's own centennial, the 50th anniversary of its first full session on this campus, and the 25th anniversary of the inauguration of its current president. The coincidence of these important milestones in 1977, however, provides Southern Seminary a unique point from which to measure its present and its future in reference to its past. 100 years ago this week, James P. Boyce stood before the faculty and students of this seminary in Louisville, its new home, to deliver the opening address of the school year. The place, a broad lecture room in Walnut Street Baptist Church. Other buildings had been rented on 2nd and Jefferson and 4th and Main for dormitories. And on 4th Street between Liberty, now then Green, and Walnut, for a library and lecture room. No building would be owned until 11 more years had passed. The faculty numbered 4, including boys. There were under 90 students. An inauspicious start, it might appear today, but not to Boyce in 1877, who could recall the seminary, his child, from its years of uncertain gestation to its humbler birth in 1859. He had witnessed the suspension of its work during the war between the states and its resumption in the first year of Reconstruction with only 7 students and an endowment of worthless Confederate bonds. Boyce it was who said in 1865, "Suppose we quietly agree that the seminary may die, but we'll die first." And the matter was decided. As Boyce addressed the school that day, he must have thought of 5 years he had left his teaching to raise money. He must have thought of those sincere, misguided souls who had opposed an educated ministry. But his words were these: "Let the history, when written, tell only of the toil and trials and sacrifices, and wisdom and prudence and foresight and prayers and tears and faith of the people of God to whom the institution will have owned its existence and its possibilities of blessing. And God grant that it may go down to succeeding ages to bless his cause and glorify his name when all of us here have been forgotten in this world forever." What was this Louisville to which the school had come in 1877? A city bursting forth in commerce, numbers, and already in nostalgia. Its population grew from 20,000 in 1835 to 125,000 in 1880. Its Courier Journal was owned by Henry Watterson, who had helped prevent secession. A second Gauld house, far more sumptuous than the one in which Dickens had slept, now proudly stood at 2nd Street and Main. As recently as 1875, Aristides had won the first Kentucky Derby. Louisville was a river town, the gateway to the South, it called itself. Steamboats went up and down the river. The Courier Journal 100 years ago gave large amounts of space to news of other river towns, as well as items on Queen Victoria, Indian skirmishes in Idaho, the death of Crazy Horse, and advertisements for ladies' kid gloves at 10 cents a pair. Sunday activities prohibited included playing marbles, quarreling, and fishing. Louisville was a theater town. In 1877, Macaulay's Theater had already been built on Walnut Street, where the Starks Building now stands, a block then chiefly residential. Here, Louisville's own Mary Anderson, age 16, made her debut as Juliet. Born the same year the seminary began in Greenville, she kept her purity with her talent, advising Sarah Bernhardt that she would look far better with less paint on her cheeks and lips. It was while in Louisville as an actor that George C. Lorimer was converted by a visitation from Walnut Street Baptist Church, later to become its minister and a noted preacher. Louisville had many mansions. James Anderson's on 6th and Chestnut was one. It had its 30-foot-long parlor, mirrors in gold Florentine frames, curved marble mantels, library, and innumerable ornaments. After 1877, such homes expanded south to Hill Street, built in French Renaissance or Richardson Romanesque or Neo-Gothic styles. Certain streets had certain visiting days for ladies who made 15-minute calls while coachmen waited outside, and loyalties were strong. Dr. Yandel declaring, "I'm for the United States, I'm for Louisville, and I'm for my side of Chestnut Street." 1877 in Louisville was a time of gas lights, mule cars, retired workers rioting brought to order by armed citizens, and a grand visit by the new president, Hayes. Louisvillians in 1877 were reading fiction by Bret Harte and Twain and many travel articles addressed to Reverend James P. Boyce of Chestnut Street, and now present in your library are 1877 Atlantic Monthly magazines containing poetry by Whittier, Longfellow, Holmes, an article by a signed South Carolinian on South Carolina morals concluding that in most matters, Southerners act morally quite like other people. But they may have a taste for liquor attributable in part to the effect of the warm climate, which requires stimulants. More disturbing was the skepticism of the time. Darwin's Origin of Species, like the seminary, created no unusual attention when it appeared in 1859, but it reached its sixth edition in 1872. Tyndall's Belfast Address of 1874 stated that we shall wrest from theology the entire domain of cosmological theory. And the scientist Romain complained of loss of faith that had caused the universe for him to lose its soul of loveliness. Meanwhile, John R. Sampi, age 13, prayed for help and his prayer was answered. The historical significance of this for him is reflected in these words he wrote. "I looked up to the old family clock on the mantel, and it was 5 minutes to 8 o'clock in the evening of March 3, 1877, the day before Rutherford B. Hayes was inaugurated as President of the United States." In Louisville, under the guidance of Dr. Boyce and his small but able faculty, the seminary prospered. Dr. Manley, one of the four founders and author of The Abstract of Principles, signed by every Southern professor since 1859, returned, and Sampi began his 57-year teaching career, and Dr. Robertson was added to the faculty. A gift of $50,000 by former Governor Brown of Georgia gave the school needed stability. Gifts from Rockefeller and others made possible the first New York Hall, and the Nortons of Louisville gave sufficient funds to build the first Norton Hall on 5th and Broadway. Dr. Boyce led the faculty until his death in 1888, when the enrollment was 164, and the seminary finally owned its property at 5th and Broadway. It was then the largest Baptist seminary in the country. Its survival is attributable chiefly to him, although ably assisted by his colleagues. Born to great wealth, reared in the culture of Charleston, educated at Brown and Princeton, he declined the presidency of two great universities, a bank and a railroad, to guide his infant seminary. He used his own resources to nurture it. A teacher of theology, he also taught his students courtesy, how to eat, to place a lady's chair and answer letters, for he wanted Southern Baptist ministers to be gentlemen. Let me digress an instant to tell you a story from my high school days. Near the end of class, a teacher caught a student napping. He told the other students to leave quietly and to caution the next class to enter softly so as not to disturb Willie. Poor Willie, who fell asleep in history, woke up in chemistry and beat an ignominious retreat. Well, I thought the tale amusing, until I heard a similar one of Dr. Boyce. One lazy afternoon, a student in his class awoke to ask the identical question Boyd had just spent 10 to 15 minutes answering. Boyce knew he had been sleeping, but without faltering, patiently turned back and trod the same intellectual road again. The Christian character of Boyce somehow eclipsed the cleverness of the other master. While the seminary was experiencing steady growth these early years, the city was spectacular. Perhaps the greatest single event was the Southern Exposition, held on 30 acres of the DuPont estate, now comprising the present Central Park. President Arthur came for the dedication in 1883. 100 men spent 30 days installing Mr. Edison's fabulous display of 4,800 incandescent lights. Families came in daylight and waited until dusk to observe, with voices hushed, the amber glow that grew to what appeared to be aisles of blinding light and beauty in the night. Some daring ones rode electric trains, being assured that the electricity would not run through the cars and affect the passengers. Other great attractions of the 1880s were pyrotechnic pageants, such as the Last Days of Pompeii at the amphitheater at Fourth and Hill, presenting 250 performers on a 250 by 400 foot stage, all for 25 cents or 10 cents for children. And from 1889 to 1904, an auditorium there featured performances by Edwin Booth, Strauss and his Vienna Orchestra, the Metropolitan Opera Company, and John Philip Sousa, and many others. Of special interest to the seminary were the Moody revivals. John Sampey, recalling the 5,000-seat tabernacle built for the occasion, spoke of the cooperation given by Broadus and other seminary faculty and students. When Ira Sankey sang, he said, "I was swept away to the gates of heaven." John A. Broadus was president of the seminary from 1889 to 1905, having been one of its four founders. In his administration, Memorial Library, a gift from Mrs. Lawrence Smith of Louisville, opened, and the original Norton Hall was completed. Together, Broadus and Boyce had worked, encouraging one another in times of stress. Broadus was the scholar, the great preacher. He became a strong force not only in the denomination but in the Commonwealth and city. The afternoon of his death, the Evening Post announced, "Dr. Broadus, our first citizen, is dying." Rabbi Moses, from his own pulpit, declared, "The glory of Louisville has departed from her with the departure of John A. Broadus." Broadus, he said, was the precious fruit by which I learned to judge the tree of Christianity. Whitsitt became president in 1896 and served 3 years until his resignation. He was a genius at knowing people, and perhaps for some, too erudite a teacher in a day when almost half the seminary students lacked college degrees and others had no high school diplomas. Unfortunately, a doctrinal dispute arose, marked by more heat than light, as the Western Recorder carried an article, "Who Lied, Dr. Whitsitt or Jesus Christ?" Finally, accepting his resignation, tendered to ensure the seminary's growth, the trustees reaffirmed their adherence to the principle of freedom of research. 8 years later, Whitsitt graciously returned to speak on Founders Day of his good friend, John Broadus, to congratulate the seminary on its success since his departure, and to tender his affection to all Kentucky Baptists who would receive it. The seminary began a new charter in its development when E.Y. Mullins was president from 1899 to 1928. The Norton Lectures were established. Founders Day was inaugurated, and at first, all classes were dismissed in celebration. The Review and Expositor began publication, and the seminary moved to its new home here, the Beaches. And exams were shortened to 5 hours. Until then, two-day examinations were required in every course. Dr. Mullen's main interests and activities brought Southern into closer contact with the community. He was a trustee of the public library, a member of numerous clubs where he met men helpful to the seminary. He gave much time to helping trainees at Camp Taylor during World War I. Others, too, were drawn to secular activities. Dr. McLaughlin was on a relief mission headed by Herbert Hoover, and Sampy gave fully half his time to war-related work. In the 1920s, the evolution crisis grew, culminating in the Scopes trial of 1925. Many feared science as a threat to religion. Mullins was a conciliatory force, feeling as he did that whatever is true by scientific reason must be true spiritually. In the Review and Expositor of 1927, Dr. Stakely argued that the seminary should encourage the archaeologist, historian, physicist, and philosopher and view science as a part of God's revelation. The city experienced many changes in the 29 years of Mullen's administration, and most of these affected life within the school. In 1922, WHAS went on the air 2.5 hours a day and carried Dr. Sampy's Bible lessons. The seminary continued religious broadcasts through the Depression when the need for public service prevailed over financial desperation. In the 20s, when Mullins was elected president of the Baptist World Alliance, marathon dances were the rage. Louisvillians were reading Dreiser, Sinclair Lewis, and Fitzgerald. Their greatest hero then was Lindbergh. A changing scale of values was suggested as the death of Rudolph Valentino attracted more attention than that of Harvard's famous President Eliot. The seminary in the city had changed since the dawn of the new century, when Prof. Johnson's father watched mules pull trolley cars on Market Street and took a paddle wheel steamboat to reach his student church at Madison each Sunday. Gone were the flickering gas jets in New York Hall, the kerosene lamps, the grate fires, the student charges based on how warm he kept his room and how late he studied. Gone were the early days of male telephone operators, all replaced by women who were found to be more courteous. Sampy was president in 1929 and inherited almost $1 million debt made serious by the Great Depression. With the help of Gaines S. Dobbins and a dedicated faculty who accepted a substantial cut in pay through 1942 without protest, the crisis was surmounted. John Sampy was militant in his service for his God and country. I knew him first as he told students in World War II, no one should come to Southern to escape the draft. I thought of coming to Southern. My first impression then was negative. But the more I learned of the man, the more admirable he became. No teacher was more colorful. None had more compassion. At the 1933 Baptist Convention, he moved that Southwestern Seminary receive a portion of the support due Southern. Thus, he alone prevented Southwestern's closing. This was while Southern still had a great indebtedness. He shunned protest. At an ecumenical meeting where he wore street clothes in the company of other dignitaries in a variety of fancy vestments, he was asked by a small, effeminate priest, "To which of the sects do you belong?" "To the male sects," he barked back. "To which sects do you belong?" Dobbins gratefully remembered Sampy's Old Testament classes where he said, "Moses, the prophets and kings marched across the stage of history with the vividness of a motion picture, yet with remarkable accuracy of detail. When Sampi retired, he was concerned because the seminary was beginning to exceed its optimum enrollment of 500. But to Dr. Fuller, president from 1842 to 1950, this was no unwelcome problem. The enrollment nearly doubled to over 1,000 by the 1950 to 51 session. But the faculty and plant grew also. Upon the death of Mrs. George Norton II in 1950, the seminary received a 22-acre estate. And in March, this beautiful chapel was completed. A particular interest of Ellis Fuller, ironically but fittingly, one of its first services was his funeral. When Dr. Bacall became the seventh president, he found an endowment well over $2 million, new classrooms and dormitories, and still the seminary grew. A much-needed apartment project was acquired and named Seminary Village. Three schools were established: theology, church music, and religious education, making Southern, in effect, a university. Teaching methods were re-examined with more attention given to research, seminars, and electives. In 1959, the Boyce Centennial Library was occupied, and in 1963, the Carver School of Missions and Social Work merged with the seminary. The Billy Graham Chair of Evangelism was established, and 8 years ago, a chair of church and community was created to meet the changing needs of a changing society. This dream child of James Boyce is now the largest private educational institution in Kentucky, with an academic program in religion ranking at the top in excellence with Harvard, Yale, and 13 others in the nation. Enrollment last year reached more than five times the number dreamed by Boyce. This would have been impossible without the support of many through the ages. Without the gifts of Governor Brown in time of special need, of Levering, Cook, Gaines, Mrs. Smith, the Mullins and McCalls, the succeeding generations of the Norton family and countless other donors, this seminary could not exist as we know it now. Above all were the gifts of energy and love. One cannot read the history of leaders of this school without reverence. Boyce, who shunned a life of wealth and ease to beg and borrow for his cherished child. Broadus, whose scholarship equipped him for a more prestigious position, but who instead in 1865 taught homiletics to a single student. Whitsitt, who left under pressure because he deemed it best for his beloved seminary. Mullins, who desired a foreign field. McCall, who left a powerful convention post to answer what he deemed to be his call. Sampi, who declined to exercise his senior privilege to teach New Testament and Greek when he thought the seminary would be better served by Robertson, with the result that they both achieved eminence in their fields. The faculty, always dedicated, especially those who served at meager salaries when the seminary was in debt. All these were donors too. As the citizens of the city have contributed to the seminary, so has the seminary given to the city its services and support. Local and nearby churches have used seminary students and faculty for pastors, teachers, trainers of church workers, and choir directors. And when the flood of 1939 drove two-thirds of Louisville citizens from their homes, all facilities of the school were put at the disposal of the mayor. For 2 weeks, this campus was headquarters for the campus, Crescent Hill area of the mayor's committee. Norton Hall housed 130 orphans. 3,000 refugees passed through these halls to other destinations that first night. Faculty and students rowed boats, gave typhoid shots, directed traffic, wrote letters, published news bulletins, and did religious ministry. 3 years ago, when the seminary itself suffered nearly $1 million damage from the tornado, classes were canceled to permit students working in the devastated Crescent Hill area to continue their volunteer efforts. They worked into the night, helping families move. A hall was made available to provide disaster victims with food, shelter, and clothing. Civil defense officials said seminary students were the backbone of the relief efforts. I speak in personal gratitude. As I surveyed the debris around my home, I saw two seminary students quietly gathering fallen bricks and stacking them neatly by the house. I'm afraid some of them are still there. By some coincidence, this had been designated Missions Emphasis Week. Dr. McCall called it the finest one in terms of service in his memory. It's in crises and in less traumatic times the seminary has served this region. Today, the seminary's faculty contribute to the social work, music, archaeology, and theology of this city. Its graduates include Catholics, Jews, and Protestants. Its music students perform with the Louisville Orchestra and Kentucky Opera Association and in churches. It attracts 5,000 visitors to its campus every year. Its archaeology museum is open to the public. It sends its graduates to all 50 states and foreign nations, ambassadors of goodwill from Louisville. It has been estimated to generate a population increase in Louisville of 6,737. I take it that's not all direct from students. And resale sales of over $10 million annually. Southern Baptists, when they think of Southern Seminary, think of Louisville. It is a steadying influence in an age of rapid change. Many years ago, a Frenchman visited this new nation and wrote of its beginnings. He saw her fields and mines, observed her commerce. "But not until I went into the churches of America," he said, "and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness, did I understand the secret of her genius and her power." Another European visitor, 7 decades ago, when asked what most distinguished his country from our own, replied, "Your observance of the Sabbath." A more recent visitor, asked the same, responded, "The litter on your streets." Social changes in our time move at an accelerating pace. I read recently that keep off the grass signs are now posted inside college dormitories. President Wesley Haynes, addressing parents of Franklin College students, put it this way: "Remember when hippie meant big in the hips? And a trip involved travel in cars, planes, and ships? When pot was a vessel for cooking things in, and hooked was what grandmother's rug might have been? When neat meant well organized, tidy, and clean, and grass was ground cover, normally green? When groovy meant furrowed with channels and hollows, and birds were winged creatures like robins and sparrows? When fuzz was a substance real fluffy and like lint, and bread came from bakeries and not from the mint? When roll meant a bun and rock was a stone, and hang up was something you did on the phone?" Increasingly, the hang-ups of this world and nation are the problems of the city and the seminary. As recently as Dr. Fuller's years, issues of DNA, pollution, integration, pornography, drugs, and sexual freedom, as we know them today, were unforeseen. These problems must be faced in the light of well-established Christian principles. In an age when suicide by adolescents are rapidly increasing, there is a need for roots, not simply biological, but moral and religious. This seminary must teach those Christian standards that have guided this fair nation and great city through the years. Intellectual humanism and hedonistic lifestyle, now called doing one's own thing, are the Scylla and Charybdis of our day. Avoiding these twin lures, we need to keep our course and show the way for others who are confused and often desperate. You will be called upon for this. Since this seminary was born, your training and your leadership have never been more needed. Give all you have, as those great men before you did. You will graduate, leaving here the influence you have had, some taking with you to some great city, a part of Louisville, of Southern Seminary, its faculty, and your classmates. Some will go to small communities. In either case, be not discouraged. In its infant days, Boyce said of the seminary when chided about its smallness, "Watch the beginning of things." Mordecai Ham, in his 50 years of preaching, had 300,000 converts. But if there had been just one, and that one, Billy Graham, who did come forward one night in North Carolina, those years would not have been spent in vain. Dr. Dobbins declared a teacher's greatness is not measured by the number of his students. Ann Mansfield taught but one, a blind, deaf mute named Helen Keller. I have spoken today of 100 years of growth. Since Southern came to Louisville, the city has increased fourfold, the seminary more than 30-fold. Its most impressive source of strength is its adherence to the faith and spirit of the founding fathers. So it must be with you. You are the founders for the future. As students, you have power to make of Louisville a city noted for its Christian love, a gem illuminating this great state and nation as truly as those original disciples had power to shake the world. This school can have no nobler dwelling than the manger, no higher tower than the cross, no smaller parish than this world we live in, no greater light than that which each of you inherited, the light of Jesus Christ. There are no more appropriate words to end this history than those majestic ones with which John Broadus concluded his memoir of James P. Boyce. O brother beloved, true yoke fellow through years of toil, best and dearest friend, sweet shall be thy memory till we meet again. And may the men be always ready, as the years come and go, to carry on with widening reach and heightened power the work we sought to do and did begin.